So as parents, we thought we had the guardrails in place. We were having the conversations, and at 14, the height of puberty, long story short, he said, I wanted to experiment with Oxy. I got it from a dealer on Snapchat. It has a hold on me, and I don't know why. That night, he died.
It seems like more and more kids are trying to cope with life and being open to experimenting with this stuff. So, I mean, what are you finding is driving that?
So, social media is the catalyst that has opened up these floodgates to our children. And these companies know it, and they have turned a blind eye to it for years.
Welcome to today's episode of Falling to Freedom, where addiction ends and faith begins. The weekly podcast that brings thoughtful, informed, and challenging discussions about addiction to the forefront of everyone's minds. We join our host now, Chad Lacombe, for today's topic.
Well, today we're joined by Amy Neville, and her story is not only emotionally hard to hear, but one that people need to hear. And it also led to many avenues of advocacy that she's involved in right now that I think are just important for certainly parents to be aware of, but just people in general to be aware of things that are out there that they may not be aware of currently. And so, Amy, thank you for joining us. And if you wouldn't mind just sharing a little bit about your personal story, sure. You know, as it relates to your son, Alexander.
Sure. Thank you. Well, thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. This really starts back in 2020. Mm-hmm. My son, Alexander, who was barely 14 at the time everything happened, which is this curious, bright, amazing kiddo who was just curious about the world around him. Mm-hmm. He was a little entrepreneur. He had an eBay store where he was selling off his childhood toys, and he was really good at it, very organized. I always felt like if he just put that kind of effort into school, it might have been a different relationship with school. He was really good at taking tests at school.
Sure.
Could pass those no problem.
Yeah. Probably without even studying.
Yeah, without even studying. Yeah. So then he would fight about homework. And so, you know, he always argued like, well, why do I have to do homework if
too smart for his own good?
Really. It's really what it felt like most days. Mm-hmm. But we were really close. We talked about a lot of things with this kiddo. Mm-hmm. We knew that he was... There would be an experimental phase from a very early age. I remember in first grade, he came home from that first Red Ribbon Week or the Drug Prevention Week at school and wanted to know more. Like, what does it mean to be high? What happens to your brain and your body? And I was like, ooh, we're in trouble. Mm. So as parents, we thought we had the guardrails in place. We were having the conversations. And as he got older, those conversations were always age appropriate. Mm-hmm. We had the internet go off at our house at night. So that way... hopefully he was sleeping through the night, that type of thing. But, you know, he'd figure it out every third day what the password was. He was very clever. And, you know, lo and behold, June of 2020, there was a funky few days and something was really off with him. And so I went to him and I asked him, I said, okay, dude, like, what is going on? Are you using something? And he was like, no, I was up late. I ate something bad, you know, and it's 14, the height of puberty, the moodiness and stuff was totally on par for his personality. So I let it go that day, but he did come back to us a day and a half later. And, you know, long story short, he said, I got to tell you guys something. And it was basically, I wanted to experiment with Oxy. I got it from a dealer on Snapchat. It has a hold on me and I don't know why. And we did what anybody would do. That following day, we called a treatment place to see what we could do to get him in. They needed to call us back with their recommendation. That night he died. Like everything happened really fast. I think it was probably, my guess is 10 days from the first pill to the day that he died.
Wow.
And I really believe that social media was the catalyst that led to his death.
Yeah. So from what I understand, he was, and this is a pretty common story as we're finding, we had other guests that their children, you know, thought they were getting one thing, ended up being a counterfeit pill laced with fentanyl. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even that in small amounts can be lethal.
Yeah. And then you got a, you know, skinny 14-year-old kiddo. He didn't stand a chance once that pill went into his mouth.
Yeah. And so 10 days. So 10 days from the day that he said, I'm experimenting with things.
It was from the time that he told us he was experimenting to the time that he died was a little more than 24 hours. we were in the waiting period of hearing back from the treatment facility. But looking back on everything, I think it maybe had been about 10 days since the first time he took a pill.
The first time he used an OxyContin.
What he thought was an OxyContin.
Or what he thought was an OxyContin. You think from the beginning they were laced with fentanyl?
Oh, absolutely.
So that's why it's like within a short period of time, he's like, I can't get free from this.
Exactly. That's why things happen so fast. One was the accessibility through social media. And second is the potency, the how highly addictive illicit fentanyl is, you know, and I don't think he ever had a legitimate oxycodone. We didn't have prescription medication like that in our house. Sure. I think it literally came from somebody that he met on social media that was able to introduce him to it.
In 2020, I mean, fentanyl was definitely around, but it wasn't in the news like it is today in 2020.
It wasn't, and it should have been. There was about 96,000 deaths that year, drug-related deaths. I mean, we're talking about when you and I were growing up, probably 5,000 people a year were dying from drugs. Mm-hmm. That year, we hit 96,000. We should have been talking about it, and we should have been talking about it way before June of 2020. And in our house, we're parents that would have listened to that message because we were trying to be on guard. We were trying to have all the right guardrails in place for this kiddo that we feared might go down this path at some point. But the thought of him dying, that never occurred to us. Like who dies from one oxy? You know, people take drugs, they experiment with drugs. Maybe they get hooked. Then they're in and out of treatment. But then something around the 8 to 10 year mark, they either have a chance of recovery or maybe they lose their life. It's certainly not in the first 10 days.
No, absolutely not. Do you know, just in kind of your experience now, having dealt with this and being in that circle, when did fentanyl actually become like prevalent?
So I believe the fentanyl really started showing up in the illicit drug supply around 2013, is when it started. There was time. So there was an on-ramp where we should have been talking about it, and we were not.
People were describing it as China white and different things like that.
People didn't quite have a grasp on what it was. Right. And then, you know, all of these pills, these oxycodone, Xanax, Adderall, whatever you want to imagine, was now being counterfeited with it. So, you know, when we got Alex's toxicology report back, the only thing he had in his system was illicit fentanyl.
So there was no oxycodone.
It was total counterfeit.
And I think from what we're learning, it's like a lot of that has to do with how cheap and potent and addictive it is. So, I mean, if you are unscrupulous and your desire is to maximize profits and get people addicted so you have customers, it's like for them, it's the perfect thing.
Yeah, it's illicit fentanyl has cut out that drug supply chain that you and I grew up with, you know, the whole war on drugs, that piece, you know, they don't have to grow poppies. They don't have to hope for good weather to yield a good crop. They don't have to put armed guards on these crops. They just can get the chemicals in, and make these counterfeit pills.
How do you think it's going with the awareness effort, you know?
I think that, you know, from 2020, from January 2024 to January 2025, we saw a 25% decrease in drug-related deaths. That's huge. Yeah. It's not enough. I think people hear that and they get comfortable. Oh, great. We're fixing the problem. We're still talking.
They're not taking into consideration what the numbers were to begin with.
We're still talking about record numbers at this point. And I don't know if you've been following what the CDC's put up about in the last few months. Drug deaths are starting to creep back up. So that is not okay. So as much education and awareness out there, there's a lot of amazing orgs, parent orgs like our own, you know, family organizations that are out there doing the work. There's these drug prevention coalitions out there that are doing the work, but, you know, grant funding is getting cut right now for these programs, and that's terrifying. We're taking money away from people who have proven that their programs work and getting people help, getting them educated, and I'm scared of what's to come.
Well, one thing that we're realizing is that, especially in California, their permissive harm reduction policies, which are kind of wrapped up in their housing first policies, really discourage like abstinence or treatment in the sense that we would think you know, you need to be off of these. You need to not be doing them because mm-hmm. they're not good. And it's more of a policy where, well, that's just how these people are. How are you to,
it's
you know,
hard.
It's judgmental for you to say that, you know, that they shouldn't be able to do these things. We just need to make them safe mm-hmm. and give them clean needles. And I mean, and then couch all of that in this conversation of compassion. Like mm-hmm. it's somehow compassionate.
It's really hard. It is really hard. But, you know, naloxone is harm reduction, and we need naloxone. Naloxone sure. is very important. And right now the funding for that's getting cut and that for first responders mm-hmm. to have naloxone. And so we need to figure out other ways to get naloxone out there and get it out to the people that need it. It's such a hard conversation because we want to help people. We also want people to be able to feel empowered to help themselves. And the thing about that with fentanyl, people don't have that moment of clarity of like, oh, I need to get my act together. This is the day I'm going to turn it around, because they go to get help. Well, come back in 30 days when we have an open bed. We don't have enough resources for when people are ready.
Sure. There needs to be more treatment options. Yeah,
it's people just are not getting that chance at recovery that they once got. Mm-hmm. And that's because, again, the lack of availability, and also fentanyl is so much stronger. People still think of heroin as the big, bad, dirty drug. I wish we were just up against heroin. We would have better chances, but unfortunately that's not the world we're living in.
There's videos out there that show like this much heroin mm-hmm. will kill a person. Yep. And then when they show fentanyl, it's like a glass jar with like two or three yep. tiny little grains yeah. that are like,
that's from our first film.
You barely have to yeah. like, you have to use a microscope to yeah. see the grains, and it's like that will kill a person. Yeah.
So people still don't get it.
So what about, you go into schools, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you speak not only with students, but with parents. Mm-hmm. How's the reception
so,
there?
This probably doesn't surprise you or your listeners, but stigma is the number one hurdle I have to overcome when it comes to talking to parents. It's mm-hmm. like, you should have just took your kid's phone away. You do drugs, you die. What do you think is going to happen? And then, of course, not my kid. My kid would never do that. Mm-hmm. The reality is, you just never know when your kid that's never going to do that might do that.
Sure.
I work with teens all across the country to create what it is that we put out as far as education and information. Mm-hmm. And they get groomed into this. Like, think sexual predator type grooming mm-hmm. is happening to our kiddos. So, your kid might be having a bad day, and the timing might just be right for a drug dealer to slide mm-hmm. in and offer them something. But what I've learned with parents, in the way to get them to listen, there's a couple of things. One is saying fentanyl poisoning instead of overdose. Mm-hmm. When I say poisoning, their guard drops a little bit. Like, wait, sure. what do you mean by that? And that really stems from the fact that as parents, we are conditioned from the day our kid is born to protect them from a poisoning. We get poison control's phone number, put it on our phones. You got the magnet that goes on the fridge. You get instructions on what to do in the event of a poisoning. And so you're prepared for that. And so it makes it relatable to the parents and the demographic that I'm really after. And then the other thing that works is, again, parents can't ever think about their kid doing something like this, but they can picture their kid being the hero in a situation. So, all right, your kid might not do it the way Alexander did it, but your kid could be the voice of reason among their friend group when these moments come up, and mm-hmm. parents will listen to that.
So are you involved at all with, I think it's Matt Capaluta, the One Pill Can Kill. Is that Matt, or is that? Basically just trying to raise the awareness that, you know, with the way it is today, if you can't guarantee that your child won't experiment with one pill, then they're in danger.
Yeah. So the One Pill Can Kill is the DEA's campaign.
Oh, okay.
And they have these virtual field trips on Operation Prevention on their website. And we were a mm-hmm. part of that, okay. creating that program or participating in the education that mm-hmm. goes out. And it's really fabulous, and it's totally free. And it's got a good, safe feel to it. So schools that get a little nervous about the content that I put out, which might be a little bit edgier, but again, that's based on what the kids are telling me what they want.
Yeah.
It's a good, safe bet.
Okay. Yeah, it's just crazy.
And that's in my first film, Dead on Arrival.
Okay. All right. Yeah, and then you and your husband, Aaron, I believe, started the Alexander Neville Foundation. Yeah. And what's that?
So with the support of my family, really, it was my sister who really stood up the foundation, and it was there for me when I was ready. I didn't have to try to do something to start up it. I was able to slide right in and start doing the work. But how I started talking to experts in this field, and I talked to every expert you can imagine and learned a lot and went to create content and realized something was still missing, and that was the youth perspective. And so starting November of 2020, mm-hmm. I started talking to teens all over the country to find out what it is they're experiencing, what it is they want to know, how they want to be treated when people come in, like, how should I dress when I show up? And that has made all the difference. I think that's what makes us a little bit different than the other drug prevention that's out there, is that we are really coming from the youth perspective.
So what are you finding? I mean, and obviously to answer these questions, it seems like, yeah, fentanyl is readily available and deadly, but it seems like more and more kids are finding themselves trying to cope with life or mm-hmm. things, you know, and being open to experimenting with mm-hmm. this stuff. So, I mean, mm-hmm. what are you finding is driving that?
So what I really believe that the social media is the catalyst that mm-hmm. has opened up this, these floodgates to our children, because we're talking younger and younger teens all the time. I mean, mm-hmm. when you were in high school and I was in high school, our friends didn't die from drugs. It just mm-hmm. wasn't a thing. I'm not saying it didn't happen, but sure. it wasn't as prevalent as it is now. Mm-hmm. Anytime I go into school, somebody knows somebody that was their age has died from this, or where social media was involved, especially. And so apps like Snapchat have given drug dealers access to our children. Mm-hmm. And these companies know it, and they have turned a blind eye to it for years. Mm.
Now, don't you have an ongoing litigation with Snapchat?
Yes.
Aren't you the lead plaintiff
yes.
on that case?
Yes.
Are you able to share a little bit about how that started, what that is all about, and maybe even update on
sure.
where it's at?
So it started in November of 2020, right about that same time, we were in a meeting with a group of parents who had all lost their kids through drugs off of Snapchat. Mm-hmm. And I made the comment, like, when are we going to get loud at Snapchat? Like, why are we just sitting here? And there was a father in that conversation. He was like, no, let's work with them from the inside. Let's show them how their product is broken and let's help them fix it. And I was like, okay, that seems reasonable. Of course they don't know, right? Well, kids continue to die. Nothing is happening. No one is speaking out about Snapchat. And so I organized a rally against Snapchat for that summer. And so in the meantime, we had a meeting with Snapchat executives that this father brought us into, to where it was like, so sorry for your loss. We had no idea this was a problem. Too bad, so sad, right?
Platitudes and
yeah,
blew
you it off. Was just ridiculous. And I was like, this is disgusting. Like, I can't even believe it was disgusting. I felt very manipulated and very taken advantage of in that situation. And so I was like, this is not my path. Working with them, working with the enemy is not how I want to do things. And so
even know what Snapchat was prior to this whole thing?
Well, you know, I had spot checked Alexander's social media throughout, you know, maybe once, maybe twice a week, because that was part of the deal of having social media. Mm. And did I know how Snapchat worked? No. Looking back on it now, had I seen drug emojis, which weren't being talked about at the time, I probably wouldn't have known it. So I was looking for, you know, bullies and sexual predators.
Sure. So can you explain a little bit about what is Snapchat? I mean, I'm sure people have heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's used frequently by mm-hmm. young people, mm-hmm. and there's a reason why.
Yeah,
and I don't think most
parents. There's a reason
parents,
why drug dealers use it too.
Sure, and I don't think most parents are aware.
So Snapchat is an app, a social media app. However, they want to tell you they're a camera company. Let's be clear about that. Where you can take pictures, send messages back and forth to people, or put them on your story or your feed, and they can disappear at whatever time you set. And so they supposedly completely disappear. So now you've got this autonomy that you might not have on other apps.
So it's kind of like an Instagram or one of those.
Yeah.
And yet the key feature is that
the disappearing
mm-hmm. of the messages. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to hide something, you don't want people to see mm-hmm. it.
That's
the only reason yep. for that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so that's the main feature. But Snap claims that since it opens to a camera and has cutesy filters, that it's a camera company.
And so you guys ended up filing a lawsuit.
So yeah, I met somebody who had asked Gretchen Peters from the Alliance to Counter Crime Online, and she said, "Have you thought about suing Snap?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, this dad says you can't sue Snap, the dad that wants to work with Snap." And she goes, "You can sue whoever you want." And like the clouds parted in that moment, and I was like, "Oh my gosh, he means we can't sue and win because of Section 230C of the Communication Decency Act, which basically labels all of it as big tech has manipulated that law to." Mm-hmm. to their advantage saying that, well, it's all free speech. Right. I will tell you, a drug menu.
Don't they often use like the analogy of a phone company?
Yeah, all the time. And it is not the same as a phone company. I mean, you are able to directly contact people. You're able to make, you know, homegrown drug menus that you can advertise. It's a marketplace, and it is an ad machine. I mean,
they're facilitating the connection. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just this, you know, random third, but they're actually trying to make connections because that drives their product.
They have a thing called quick ad where kids can just quickly add whoever shows up in that quick ad feed. Mm-hmm. And that gives them a higher snap score, which gives them more clout, makes them feel more important. So it's driving that dopamine hit to their brains, which in turn creates that addiction that kids keep going back to these apps again and again and again. And so they hide behind Section 230C. And so that was why, you know, we couldn't sue, as we would lose because of that. It's been happened time and time again. However, you know, we met Carrie Goldberg, was introduced to Carrie Goldberg from her law firm, who introduced us to the Social Media Victims Law Center. And they really took a huge chance on us. And right now, you know, the bellwether cases have been announced. Those are the cases that will be the first ones to trial. Mm-hmm. And so we are moving into discovery on those cases. The judge has allowed to move it.
That's pretty huge, Because now they have to open up their internal documents and books. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And to me, that's the win. Like, we are way further in this case than anybody ever anticipated. Social Media Victims Law Center was told not to take this case by everybody out there. But Matt and Laura and Glenn, they are all about doing what's right. Mm-hmm. And that is why they believe in this case. They believe in us. Mm-hmm. And they're smart. They're so smart. And they've been able to present it in a way that has allowed us to make it as far as we had.
Well, that's good. I mean, the reality is, you know, these companies aren't going to change unless it hits their pocketbooks.
100%. I mean, it's going to take lawsuits and legislation to make this happen. But right now, any legislation that's come up, like the Kids Online Safety Act, which would make them have to do a solid duty of care, among other things, they're lobbying against it. They come out and say they publicly support various bills, but meanwhile, they're behind the scenes lobbying against it. Last year, every day that legislation was in session, they spent over $200,000 a day to fight these bills.
Mm. What do you think their motivation is?
They've got to protect their profit. I mean, they're...
You think if they put these protections in place and do these common sense things, it will affect their bottom line?
What will happen is there'll be less engagement. Right. You know, advertising won't reach kiddos. They won't be able to harvest that data on everybody in the way that they do right now. And so their profits will drop.
I mean, that's pretty much the story with all of these social media companies.
Absolutely. It's all of them.
People don't realize, they think that you know, the app and the stuff is the product, and they don't realize they're the product.
That's what I tell the kiddos. They're the product. That's what I tell the kiddos. I'm like, if nothing else, you should be mad that you're not getting your cut at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's pretty terrifying with all of the AI stuff that's coming out and being able to manipulate the information that you're putting online.
And right now, with the executive order to have an AI moratorium, that's terrifying. Have we not learned from the mistakes of social media? Why are we going to do this again?
So what about, if you could just share a little bit about just the addictive nature of social media in general? I don't think that people realize that, I mean, these companies and their products were designed to, you know, trigger those things to make them addictive.
So it is, when I talk to kiddos about it, one of the things that we talk about is the Snap score. So Snap gives you a score for certain things that you do online, and other apps have their version of that. You earn a badge or whatever it is. And kiddos tell me at first it's fun. You know, it's fun. It's gamified. They go and they do it. But after a while, it gets exhausting. They hear the notification, and it gives them a little tinge of anxiety because now they have to go do this Snap streak. They're like hooked on doing it. One, because they're worried about losing their Snap score. Two, because it's giving them that dopamine hit. Now their bodies become reliant on this machine, their phone, their video game, their social media, whatever it is, to fulfill that dopamine need that their brain has, and they can't go without it. And so,
do you know of any studies that have been done to like, I mean, it seems obvious when you say that, and I'm sure there's a lot of pushback from these social media companies to suppress any studies, but there's got to be stuff out there.
Yeah, well, you know, Mark Zuckerberg came out and says that our studies show that there's no link between mental health issues and social media.
You know what I'd like to ask him? Do your kids use it?
And they don't. We know that they don't. These executives have said that their kids don't, they don't allow their kids on these platforms. So at the same time, you know, they market it right to our kids.
Oh, absolutely.
So as far as studies go, Jonathan Haidt has some, and his team have done some really good reporting out there on it. He has the book, The Anxious Generation. Mm-hmm. It's a really helpful, insightful book for parents. It'll help give some parents some insight on what's going on. There's a book out there called Careless People that is from a former Meta executive, and that will give you some great insight into it. Like, it's, I felt like I was reading a thriller actually the whole time I was reading it. She gets into some of the things that they do.
Kind of like a whistleblower.
Yeah. She's a whistleblower. Okay. Yeah. So she has some great information. And then of course the film Can't Look Away takes a look at how these companies manipulate teens.
Well, what would be your recommendations to parents? I mean, it's like, how do you, I mean, kids' lives are just like,
so
wrapped up in these things.
Yeah, there's
right?
a whole
it's,
fear of missing.
It's almost like it's so hard. Like, as a parent, you may be like, I don't want to give my child a cell phone until they're 15. But it's like there's so much social pressure to give them one at 10 or something. How do you, I mean, what would be your advice to parents to navigate this whole social media
trap? It's hard. It is really hard. And I'm not going to discount that whatsoever. It is harder than it should be. These companies need to help us out in doing better for our kids in these spaces. And I wish just taking the phone away would solve it, but it's not. In fact, that's probably going to create other problems. I'm sure parents that are listening, they've taken a phone away from their kid, right? 20, 30 minutes later, the kid is on full freak out because they want their phone. They need their phone. They need their phone. That's the dopamine issue. That's the dopamine depletion. And so it seems like your kid's being a brat or moody or whatever it is, but it's bigger than that. So if you have...
There's an actual physical addiction
absolutely.
To those.
When I go and talk to kiddos, I talk to them. We talk about their social media use when we do the listening sessions. And then we talk about how, I'm like, put your phone in another room. See how long you go before you have that compulsion to have your phone. That's what addiction feels like. And that is a sign that maybe we need to do something about it. So we talk about kind of how to wean themselves off of it, to look at their, because you know, every phone tells you how long you're on every day. Look at that. Maybe put some settings on that. Put some barriers between you and getting on your apps, like taking all your apps and putting them into a file on your phone that says think. That way, when you go to try to go to that, there's that barrier. And then you can stop and think like, wait, if I get on this app right now, did my mom tell me to walk the dog? Am I supposed to be doing something with my brother or sister? Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, am I going to get in trouble? And that way they can stop that impulsive. It puts something between them, that impulse to go check that. And hopefully they can start seeing what's going on there. But as far as parents go, you have to wait as long as you can. There are a couple studies out there. I wish I could tell you which they are off the top of my head. I can't remember. But that show us that if we can keep our kids 16, 17 years old before we give them phones, then they are less likely to care about social media when they do get them because they've learned how to live without it at that point.
Yeah, I think that's borne out in like – probably our lives, right?
Yeah.
Not growing up with that, we're able to just put it aside, shut it off, and not deal with it because it wasn't a part of our life from early
on. I mean, when I go out in the world, I watch families because a lot of times I'm on the road, so I'm going to dinner or lunch by myself, and so I people watch, and it's just so many families with their kiddos at the table.
Everyone's sitting there on their phone.
Yep, they're all. No one's connecting with each other. It's really wild kind of what we're turning into out here. But the other thing too, if you are a parent that's really losing the fight to your kid getting a phone or whatever's going on there, again, like I want to be crystal clear, like you got to wait as long as you can. But again, if you're losing that fight, there is a book out there called Healthy Screen Habits. Think of it as like a driver's license manual to getting your kiddo online. It's helpful in that thing. One of the things it says in the book that I really like for a kind of a rule of thumb for all of us, even us adults, is like, if you don't want your grandma to see it, don't put it online.
Good advice. Yeah. And then are there like, I mean, I think there's controls that you can, like if you give your child a phone, you don't have to give them an iPhone that has access to everything, right?
Right. There is. So there's some things you can do, and you can get an old school flip phone. I mean, that right there, they're kind of making a slow comeback right now for parents who want to do that. So that is one thing. Another thing is, yes, there's all of these social media apps have parental controls. kids know how to work around them. Mm-hmm. When there's an update, sometimes they fall away. Snapchat, they don't allow third-party software to work with their app. So mm-hmm. you think maybe you've done it, your due diligence, and it's not actually working. So, but go in, put everything on the safest settings that you possibly can. No location sharing. That's a big deal. Snap has some of the best location GPS in the world. So turn that off. Bad people can find your kid very easily. And I know kids like to have it because they like to see which friends are in their vicinity and so on, but it's really not necessary. It's really not. So that's something you can do. And again, the third-party apps like Bark or Life 360, you can put those on mm-hmm. on a phone. But again, they don't always necessarily work the way you might think they do. And sometimes it's a delayed message that you get that something's going on. So you, and then also I think something that's really important to do is if your kid has social media, part of the deal, you have to have the passwords because God forbid something happened, you need to access that phone, right? There's that right there. The other thing is you got to spend two, three times a week, 5 to 10 minutes at a time scrolling through their For You feed. Their For You feed or the recommended content. So the algorithmic.
Is this just specific to Snapchat?
No, or all of them have it. So, you know, when you go onto social media and it's like, you might like this or For You, or that's what they're pushing to you.
Okay, this is what the social media company is pushing to your child. Mm-hmm. And that isn't that going to be typically based on what they're searching for?
Yes, in theory, yes. But let me give you an example. Let's say you're a 14-year-old girl, you are on the soccer team, it's summer, and you want to get a soccer workout. So you search soccer workouts on Instagram. You're going to get a totally normal soccer workouts right at first and nutrition, but it's going to start to get a little bit edgier and edgier and edgier until where you find yourself in what's called the anorexia bubble. And it's
and this disordered. Is being pushed by the social media companies?
Yeah. It's why? What, it's what, because it, it's supposed
to. Do they want anorexic children?
It drives engagement.
Okay.
The spookier, scarier, depressive content just drives engagement.
It's like engagement. The news. Mm-hmm. Fear.
Yep.
Anxiety. Yep. Anger. They want stories like that because that's what drives viewership.
It's exactly what drives viewership. One of the things in the book Careless People that the author talks about is how Meta figured out on Instagram that if a girl put out a picture, a teen girl put out a picture and she felt bad about it or nobody liked it, she would take it down. And that was an opportune time to push beauty products and things at them.
Wow. Just corruption.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And certainly putting profits before the health of people mm-hmm. and our children mm-hmm. and what's generally good for society.
Yeah, exactly.
So you had mentioned something concerning Snapchat. Yeah. Maybe you could just kind of flesh it out a little bit with, even if parents are checking their children's phones uh-huh. and they're looking at their Snapchat uh-huh. and stuff like that, you mentioned there's some emojis and there's things mm-hmm. that are like specific to drug dealers mm-hmm. that you weren't aware of before. Mm-hmm. Can you share what those sure. are?
So it's called the drug emoji code. And actually, if you just go into your computer browser and type in DEA drug emoji code, you're going to get a 2-page PDF okay. that shows you what these are and what different combinations of emojis mean when it comes to the drugs. And even that's not enough because these drug dealers are super smart.
They're probably changing all the time.
They're super smart. They know how to change it up and get through to our
what's
kiddos.
That site again? Or what's that?
It's just type in DEA drug emoji code and it'll come right up.
And okay, and that's being used primarily on Snapchat or other sites as
All of them. I mean, this problem, in my opinion, Snap has been the largest open-air drug market, especially when it comes to our younger teens.
Because they disappear.
Yeah. That's where it's been prevalent. But nowadays, you know, when we first started talking to kiddos, they knew that these drug dealers were there and mm-hmm. now these drug dealers are meeting them there, but maybe they're sending them off to Signal or WhatsApp to finish these transactions mm-hmm. where it's even more encrypted and less likely that they'll ever be found out. So it really is a combination of all these apps these days. Mm-hmm. They're just really clever at how they do it.
So what are some other things, you know, besides trying to have these parental controls on social media mm-hmm. and obviously from the litigation side, trying to force them to change their mm-hmm. ways? I mean, it seems like having some things that encourage kids to just do the things that we enjoyed when right? we were kids that involve actual real relationships.
It's hard. You know, it's hard. It's going to take parents that are committed to do this. Like there's going to be a group of parents at a school somewhere that's going to be able to all really agree to making this commitment mm-hmm. of not giving their kids phones until they're however old they decide, and really sticking to that. Mm-hmm. But it's hard. I was at a school last year, a private school last year, where they had all done the wait until eighth pledge. And I was talking to kids in kindergarten through eighth grade that mm-hmm. day. And when I started in a fourth grade classroom, and I asked the kiddos, how many of you go to bed with a device? And half the class raised their hand. And the mom that I was with, her eyes about fell out of her head. She's like, we've all pledged the wait until eighth. Clearly it's not happening. And so it's really hard.
Their whole social fabric is wrapped mm-hmm, around that. Yeah. So it's like, you're basically telling your child to be ostracized mm-hmm. from their mm-hmm. community by not being able to engage the way all the other kids are.
And it's interesting. I think that we need to empower our kids too, though, help them understand that it is okay not to have social media. Mm-hmm. It is okay if your friend group makes a phone call. We need to teach them how to use the phone again. We were at a soccer club, and the person I was presenting with said, oh, just ask your parents to get a landline. And they were like, 13-year-old boys, what's a landline? We're like, oh no. So we have to reintroduce these old school tools to them. Mm-hmm. And we have to teach them how to communicate without it, which is really insane to think that mm-hmm. that is really what we're up against. You know, and another huge push, I think, is the ed tech movement right now, getting tech out of classrooms. I mean, our kids are all indoctrinated with Google from the time they go into public school all mm-hmm. the way through. Now they're this lifelong customer for Google, and they're on these platforms or on YouTube Kids, that is their school issued device, but harm is still reaching them. Mm-hmm. I have a friend, Nikki, whose daughter was in third grade last year, was getting pushed cutting content through her school issued device on her school issued Google account.
How does that happen? YouTube. I mean, unless she's searching that.
She's not. It showed up as an ad as she was going along.
And then if she clicks on it, it's like, whoa, mm-hmm. what the heck is this? Now it's going to start pumping it more and more.
It'll feed that.
Not that you were like wanting to do that. For that.
But then what happens once you get into that world where an eating disorder, it looks like everybody's doing drugs or everybody's cutting on themselves, at 30, 45 days, mm-hmm. these, you know, developing frontal lobes think this is normal and think, okay, well, today's the day I'm bored enough. I'm going to try it or whatever it is.
Do you happen to know just off the top of your head numbers of suicide incident that is related to social media?
I don't know.
I know it's high.
It is high. It is. I work with families. In fact, the same day that we lost Alex, my dear friend Kristen Bride lost her son Carson. Same platform, same day, different harm. He took his own life after being intensely bullied through Snapchat.
Mm. And this was your friend.
Through our shared.
And then it became mm-hmm. revealed that it was on the same.
Exact day. I remember meeting her for the first time and she said the date and I was like, wait, say that again. Since then, together we have founded the Social Media Harms Victims Remembrance Day every June 23rd.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's good stuff. Yeah. So, I mean, it was only 5 years ago, right?
That
you lost Alexander mm-hmm. and you seem very, composed about it, and I think that probably is a result of you talking about it repeatedly mm-hmm. at different things. But how are you doing? This is not an easy thing to deal
with. It's not. It is incredibly difficult. It was either the night of or the day after Alex died. I was in his room, and there was a. Now you're going to make me cry. So here it comes. there is a little piece of paper on the corner of a piece of paper taped on his wall. And I asked his dad, I'm like, what was here? Like, what was here? And he's like, I can't remember. It said something about do hard work, do the hard things. And we couldn't remember. Well, fast forward 2 months, I'm scrolling through my husband's phone, just looking for any picture I haven't seen of Alex before, whatever connection I can find. Right. And there's the picture of the piece of paper. And it said, practice rigorous authenticity, do uncomfortable work and surrender the outcome. Mm. And that do uncomfortable work is like my mantra. It is what gets me out of bed every day. And so that is my goal it's a weird combination of me running from my emotions while I'm talking about them at the same time. The fact that I get to talk about him almost every day is a treat. And I feel like, you know, Alex lived for 14 years, that I could talk about him for at least that amount of time. And so it's where I find my purpose, you know, and It's when I go to a school, I always give out my personal information, and I always hear from a kid, always, whether it be they need naloxone because of their parents' drug use, or they're in an abusive situation, or their best friend's using pills. You know, I one time even went back to school and helped a young lady advocate for herself, and she was able to go into, she was very suicidal. She had the means, she had the letter, and I was at the right place at the right time to help her get through that. So those things make it all worthwhile. But I will tell you, you could put 30,000 kids in front of me and say, you saved their lives. You can, they can go away and you can have Alex back. I'll take Alex every time.
Yeah, absolutely. We are so grateful that you are, you know, in this sphere and advocating. And I know the pain that you are obviously still experiencing, even if it doesn't come out when you're, you know, talking about these things, you know, sort of from the outside and just trying to help people. But the pain is real.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm sure it drives you.
It does. You know, it's
motivates you to get on all those planes and get in that car and drive and
do this. It really does. It really does. Because when it comes to the work I do at the foundation, I don't take a paycheck for it or anything. I can't even imagine doing that. It is really a labor of love.
All right. Well, we really appreciate you being willing to come and share. And do you want to just real quickly just share any websites, any social media or whatever?
Sure.
That's probably like, so, we don't want to say that, but
anything that you think would... We have social media. Yeah. We know that's where the kids are.
Sure. Stuff that would be helpful to listeners, not only parents, but also children.
If people want to learn more, if they go to our website, alexandernevillefoundation.org or anfhelp.org, they will find our some of the films that we've done, Dead on Arrival, Come Back Home, and The Safest Place, all short 20 to 25 minute PSA style documentaries, and they're free to watch. And then there is the full length documentary there put out by Bloomberg Media called Can't Look Away. That is the case against social media. People will learn a lot from it. It is a donation link for me that Bloomberg made. However, they can change the price to zero and watch it for free. So there's some more to learn out there.
Yeah, and I did watch that, and it was very informative. So I would recommend that as well.
Thank you.
Okay, well, Amy, thank you so much again for coming and joining us. And we're going to be praying for your efforts there against Snapchat and everything that you put in your hand to.
Thank you for being a part of this much-needed conversation as we expose the raw truths about addiction. Don't forget to like, follow, and most importantly, share. Remember, addiction is the dirty little secret that every family deals with, but nobody wants to talk about.